Gray Wolf Computer System has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, June 4th, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, Derek Story joins us for a discussion on digital photography. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org, click on the Geeks, and send us a message that way, which will show up on our email. I'll be giving out that contact information in about a half an hour when I invite your participation to Geek Speak. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are Geek Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta, and Thespian Miles Elam. Miles, you open a play tonight in beautiful Ben Lomond, Mount Community Theater, my alma mater, if you will, for theater. It's called Love on the Loathsome Stage, and you play a frat boy. Yeah. How's it going? How are the rehearsals going?
You know, the role's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
It's going well. Uh-huh. I highly encourage folks to show up.
Okay, it's playing this weekend, 8 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, next weekend, 8 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, and a Sunday matinee this weekend at 2.
Does not have Sunday matinees. It's only Fridays and Saturdays.
Fridays and Saturdays for 2 weekends.
Three weekends.
That's a lot of commitment there, Miles.
I don't know. It seems like a short run to me. A lot of work for just a few shows.
You know, that's how theater is. You get that energy going. And
they're just going to be getting good. Then it's over.
So
and then you're a frat boy.
Mount Community Theater presents a fundraiser, melodrama, lots of interaction from the audience, popcorn and drinks are served.
With some adult-oriented content, be aware of this.
Good point. Fridays and Saturdays for the next 2 weekends at Park Hall in Ben Lomond. To learn more information, you can go to mctshows.org. Good luck tonight, or I should say break a leg, and I hope you take a nap before the show starts. Okay, you're listening to Geek, though contrary to what you might think at this point, you're listening to Geek Speak. Before we get into our discussion on digital photography with Derek Story, what's up in the technical world? Sean?
Yeah, Dell has begun offering double capacity, double layer DVD burners as an option on several of its desktops, notebooks.
What does that mean for the size of a DVD you can burn?
It means that instead of 4.7 gigabytes of data, you can now burn 8.4 gigabytes of data.
I want one.
And these new drives are 12x in speed.
Whoa, so you can do it fast.
Yeah. So an 8x burner, right now you can burn a DVD in about 10 minutes. So
maybe this is the solution for archiving photos. I'm still looking. We'll talk a little bit about that with Derek.
Wait a second. When it says 8x and 12x, it takes how long on a normal DVD to burn?
Well, a DVD on a 4x DVD, if you think of it as if a 1x speed, would be in 2 hours.
1x is about 1.5 megabytes of data per second. So a 1x drive takes about an hour to burn a disk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're doubling the data rate, or doubling the data density, but you have that fast. So that's not going to be...
It's weird logic.
It's going to increase the time, of course, because it's double the amount of data. But 12x is then increases the speed of the burn. So I would guess about 20-25 minutes.
It'd be a normal 6x. So yeah, it'd be 1/6 of an hour, equivalently.
Right then. Okay.
Okay. Now that we've confused everybody, including ourselves.
Like I said, about 20 minutes.
When is this technology coming out?
It's available now. So if you were to go order a Dell Dimension 8300 or an XPS desktop, this is a feature that you can now.
And I'm assuming this is backwards compatible. And like you can read single density drives, disks with this.
Yeah, and you can burn single density, single layer disks too.
Great, very cool. Just doubling the density of personal DVD burning systems. And I guess if you're thinking about buying a DVD, you might as well get this now because That's the next realm, if you will.
Yeah, well, there's new technologies coming out on the horizon, like Blu-ray, that increase the size of a disc that a disc can hold to like 20-something gigabytes.
We're going to have somebody on the show talk about Blu-ray specifically. Sean, thank you for that. Miles?
The Linksys WRT54G 4-port wireless G router, broadband router.
Okay, a broadband router.
Yes. This is what you use to connect to, for example, your DSL connection. It also supplies wireless to your home.
And it supplies a type of firewall called a router, which is kind of like a firewall.
Well, it has firewall software in there. Okay. It runs an embedded version of Linux.
Now, you're running one of these at your house,
and
right?
I have one of these at my home and was quite surprised to find a notice saying that there was a security vulnerability with them. Because to my knowledge, I had not heard of any security vulnerabilities with these hardware routers. But this one apparently has a problem where you're not supposed to be able to administer it. There's a web administration console for it. You're not supposed to be able to administer them from outside the house, especially if you don't turn that administer from outside the house checkbox. However, you can.
That's not good.
Right. Even if you check the thing saying you're not allowed
from
outside.
Yeah, this is a serious vulnerability.
Yes. Especially when folks don't change their default password. If you change your default password, then you would have much less of a problem.
Okay, so how do you do it? I mean, how do you, if I wanted to get into your router and it wasn't, the workaround wasn't invade, how would I do it? Just access the router and look at the web server and it would work?
Right. You go in there and you change settings or update the firmware, change to something
so you
else.
Just visit the you just visit that IP address and a web server's there and you just administer the box if the admin password
is
changed.
Big deal is these things only cost about $70, so a whole bunch of people went out and went, this is a great deal, like, for example, my house did.
What do you do to protect yourself?
There are, part of the firewall software is pass-through. It allows you to, for example, if you're running a web server in your home, you can say open up port 80 to point to this particular computer inside my house, but it doesn't open up for everything. It just opens up one particular port for a service. It just so happens that I had opened up a port for web serving.
And so now when someone visits your router to administer it from the outside, instead of doing that, all the traffic goes to a computer that's inside your network.
Right.
And so I would assume that even if you don't have a web server and you don't want to host anything, to disable this feature, all you have to do is set up that, what is it called? Redirecting or forwarding?
Yeah, port forwarding.
Port forwarding for port 80 to some fictitious IP address internally, and you'll be set.
Right, exactly. That's what you're supposed to do. It doesn't have to point to a computer. It just can point to some arbitrary entity.
Let's refresh this just so we understand. Linksys routers, personal routers with the wireless attached as well.
The WRT54G.
Okay. Is it only the WT?
Yes.
4-2G?
To my knowledge, yes.
Okay. That router has a vulnerability where people can administer it from the outside. First off, change the default password. Second off, open up port forwarding or pass-through for port 80. You want to enter port 80.
Port 80 and port 443, which is secure.
Port 80 and port 443. Put two entries for those and make some IP address. Doesn't matter what it is.
Now, do you select both TCP and UDP? Because those are two checkboxes.
UDP, wouldn't matter.
Yeah, UDP would not matter.
So just TCP is all you need to worry about.
Because web servers and the administration software only goes through TCP.
And it asks you for a range, so you'd put port 80 to port 80 if you just wanted to do port 80.
These actually say specific ports.
Linksys actually asks for a range.
But not
this particular model.
He uses
it. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So your Linksys must be more.
I've seen the ones that you're talking about. This is not the case. This one's, you say which port it was, where it goes to inside.
Okay, Miles, thank you very much for that. Again, the model number for this router?
The Linksys WRT54G 4-port wireless G broadband router.
This is good information for anybody.
I agree.
Yeah,
Miles,
it has an admin on any broadband router, change the password.
Change the password. Thank you very much. Sean?
Yeah, there are several tech conferences going on right now that are very interesting. One is happening in New York. It is the Society for Information Displays International Symposium, and they're looking at future display technologies, 3D monitors that can track your eye movement, some really high-end detailed 3D computer monitors that go for around $12,000 or so. And they're also looking at making these smaller and putting them in cars. So some of the things they're talking about doing is maybe a dashboard screen to monitor the kids in the back seat, maybe a television sewn into your shirt sleeve. They're working on that kind of technology. of course, the 3D computer monitor that tracks eye movement is perfect for, you know, hardcore gamers and heart surgeons. So
great.
This is the kind of stuff they're looking at. The other big show is happening in Taipei, Taiwan. It is called...
Now, this is the one you almost went to, right?
Yeah, I'm supposed to be there. But I pulled out for personal reasons. This is at it's called Computex, and it's probably the industry's largest show, next to CeBIT in Germany. Computex is really cool. It's a very gadgety show. A lot of companies line up their product announcements for this show, and I hope to do a little roundup maybe next week on all the cool stuff because there's just so much to look for.
Great. We look forward to that.
But ATI released the Radeon X800, X600, and X300 graphics chips. These are really high-end gaming chips. So we should see cards based on those chips soon, especially for the new games coming out this summer. And Bink, a consumer electronics company from Acer, unveiled the Joybee 102 MP3 player. It's the world's smallest and lightest MP3 player.
How big?
They don't have a lot of detail. I need to go do some research.
All right. Well, next week,
I'm hoping to set up some interviews with some companies, too, because there are some new fan and case technologies that are just amazing.
Quiet and pretty, I'm assuming.
Oh, just amazingly quiet. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Sean, for that update. We look forward to more information next week. Miles?
Yes. I'm sure all of us have come across the emails that are from a corporate entity that at the bottom they say this is the property of so-and-so. It may be legally privileged and or confidential and it's intended only for the use of the addressee. You know, if you copy this or print it, we're going to take your firstborn.
Yeah, I see some companies doing that and some personal people doing that too.
Right. As it turns out, from looking at an analysis from a lawyer, they're mostly ineffectual. Just so people shouldn't be all that worried about them. When it talks about, for example, this is a property of so-and-so, it's technically true, but you've sent it to someone else. Just by sending a letter, you're giving them an implied license to view and look at and print and copy. And most of the times you'll see a clause saying, like, no addressee should forward, print, copy, or otherwise reproduce this message.
I'm confused. Sum this up again.
Basically, corporations put a legal tag at the bottom of the email and force their employees to send that out as well. That doesn't really have any binding.
Right, which is really curious, the fact they put it at the bottom of the message after you've already read it.
Right.
Don't read. Yeah, the thing you just read, don't read that.
If you don't want someone to read something, then don't send it to them.
Yeah, no kidding. Thank you, Miles, for that. Sean, one more story for the day?
Yeah, this is actually kind of a heads up. There's a new study that shows that there is toxic dust in our computers. Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition did a big survey, basically looking for specific brominates. They're PBDEs, penta and octa brominated diphenyl, and they're linked to all kinds of nasty things.
Probably carcinogenic.
Yeah, like brain problems in fetuses and autism.
And why are they in our computers?
Well, in the 1970s, computer manufacturers thought it'd be a good idea to put this in the plastic used in our computers. To help prevent fires.
So it's a fire retardant.
So it's the same retardant that's used in fire extinguishers, fluorescent lights, and liquid insulators since the 1920s. And they're finding a long exposure with this can be a problem.
Great.
But they said you shouldn't throw out your computers, and you don't need to wear special gloves to minimize exposure. And there's no known way to remove dust-borne PBDEs. So special wipes and sprays wouldn't reduce chemical exposure.
So is it a touch thing, or does it go into the dust and you breathe it?
Yeah, you breathe it.
Wait,
so I guess the best thing would be have
and
ventilation
I'm sure
in the
you
room.
Absorb it through your skin, too, at some point.
Well, so if you want to really be on top of it, the reason, Miles, is that inside the computer, the heat is changing the plastics, right? So you have it's contracting and increasing
right,
in size.
Okay.
So the molecules inside the thing get in, and then they get injected into the room. There's nothing you can do except for wear, like, a serious mask setup. But the other thing you could do is you could have a negative pressure room. Basically, you take a fan to a window, if you're really concerned about this, and just have the fan blowing outside all the time. What it'll do is cause a small current in the room, and the gas particles will actually leave the room.
As long as you have the window open.
Have the window open and have the air blowing
out. So penta and octa brominated diphenyl will be taken off the market by the end of the year. Good. And environmental groups are pushing to get the deca brominated diphenyl, which is the PBDE that's in the equipment, to be taken off.
Well, it might be time to upgrade your machine. Sean, thank you for that story. Yeah. Miles, one more for the day.
Before XL, before Lotus 1T3, there was VisiCalc. 25 years ago. Happy birthday, VisiCalc. The beginning of the electronic spreadsheet.
Woohoo!
The one that started it all.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. We're talking about digital photography today with Derek Story. Derek Story is a photographer and author of the O'Reilly published Digital Photography Hacks, which I've got in front of me, a nice little book of 100 tips and tricks for photographers. Derek, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, Lyle. Glad to be here.
Derek, let's start out because you're a digital photographer. And you know your stuff. You're a publisher. You've published at least three books or written three books on the subject. What camera do you use?
Well, I don't use just one camera, of course. I have a number of cameras. But, you know, my saying is, you know, because people ask me all the time, what's the best camera to have? And, mm-hmm. you know, my tongue-in-cheek remark, not so tongue-in-cheek, but to some degree, is, you know, the camera that you have with you. So... You know, because, you know, photographers sometimes get wrapped around this notion that they have to have the best camera in the world, which is sometimes kind of big, sometimes kind of bulky, and sometimes at home on the dresser when a great shot appears. So I always make sure I have a pocketable camera with me. Uh-huh. Right now there's a couple that I like. The Canon Digital Elves are, you know, perennial bestsellers, and for good reason. They're really well made and take very good pictures.
And are they pretty small?
Pretty small. I mean, you can fit them in definitely in your front pocket, no problem. And if you have a, you know, like an industrial stitched T-shirt, you can even get it up in the top pocket. But it might stretch it a little bit. And then there's some...
Sean, is that the camera you have in front of you? Is that a Canon Elf?
It sure is. The PowerShot S400.
The S400 is actually right now, I think, is the best deal going.
Because, it's a really good camera. Very impressed with it.
Very good camera. And, you know, they came out with... A newer model, which really didn't change very much, and it drove the price down on the S400 a little bit more. And, you know, in that S400, you're carrying around 4 megapixels, very good movie mode, very good glass.
And it's only slightly larger than a deck of cards.
It is. And it uses compact flash, too, which is, you know, a lot of times, you know, that's an advantage unless you have a... You know, unless you're tied into some other kind of memory card.
The memory card choices, Sony always releases stuff with the Sony memory stick, except for their high-end SLRs. They actually add a flash card as well. Most high-end cameras use flash cards, and flash cards are great because micro drives are available in really large sizes. And then other medias like smart media, and there's probably 15 other degrading in... not quality, but degrading in use, you know, less,
right.
more unfamiliar stuff.
I think an up-and-comer right now is Secure Digital.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really like a small compact flash card. You know, they have that same kind of nice, beefy feel to them. I've had really good luck with them. And they do have one advantage, which is if you carry a PDA or if you have a smartphone that takes memory cards, a lot of times you can take the pictures... the memory card right out of your camera and mm-hmm. put it in your PDA, and then there are all sorts of really cool applications to play with them.
Yeah.
Really terrific if you travel a lot.
Yeah. Now, of course, that's a big part of it. You know, if you already have a PDA and you don't have a camera, and your PDA takes smart media, like a Clié or something,
mm-hmm.
Sony memory stick, rather, you might want to get a camera that supports that, because then you do have some kind of, you know, ability to transfer back and forth.
It's definitely something to think about, and you might also have... you know, some memory lying around too that you know you could repurpose. You know, the smaller memory cards aren't really great for, you know, going on a 2-week vacation,
right.
But they are nice for handing to somebody else if you want to just give them a few shots. And
they're also great. I like I have got a 64, which isn't exactly a flash card in my SLR camera case
mm-hmm.
because in case I fill up my main card, I've got, you know, a few more shots that I can take.
That's a little bit of backup.
Yeah,
it's like the, you know, the low fuel light on your automobile.
Right.
You go, oh, got a gallon, better find a gas station real quick.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
Another good use, too, that a lot of people are taking advantage more and more, which is if you just want to go to a kiosk at a photo store, at a mall, they're showing up everywhere now, and just make a few prints.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, it's always kind of handy to have those cards so you don't have to put your 512 in there.
Okay, let's talk a little about your book directly. What's another camera you have? Like, do you have an SLR camera?
Oh, yeah.
What do you got? What do you like?
Well, I like the Canon 10D myself. A lot of folks, if they're getting their first digital SLR, There's two that I like. One is the Digital Rebel, which is a terrific camera.
And that's a Canon as well?
That's a Canon as well. And I just read there's a hack that was on Flashdot the other day where if you use the latest firmware on that Digital Rebel, there's a hack that unlocks a whole bunch of features that are on the 10D that weren't initially on the Digital Rebel. And you can actually bring it up almost to the 10D level in terms of functionality. So that's kind of cool. It's a great camera for less than $1,000. And then, of course, Nikon has really stepped up to the plate now. And I believe it's their D100.
D70 is the most recent.
D70, mm-hmm. And that's the one that's just right under $1,000.
It's actually a little over $1,000, the D70.
In camera stores?
Yeah, is that the one you got?
So yeah, I guess you can get it without the lens, I guess, for $99. Yeah, that's
right. Exactly. Yeah. Without, which, you know, I think a lot of Nikon shooters probably have some glass around already.
Right.
But, you know, that camera, you know, has a lot of the Nikon traits that, you know, we appreciate. And you know, one of them is just really good performance, you know, in terms of burst mode and things like that. It's, I think it's the first camera that they've introduced for, you know, kind of the rest of us that maybe aren't really ready to spend a whole lot of money but want that Nikon interface.
I got to say, I've been using I bought a Nikon D70 about a week and a half ago.
What do you think of it?
I couldn't be happier. It's
yeah.
a wonderful camera. And the reason I like it so much is I grew up using Nikon, you know, manual cameras, you know. And so it is just like that. It's just really wonderful. And, of course, the automatic features on it are wonderful. The lens that comes with it's a great lens.
That's the 18-70, right?
That's right.
It comes with it. Yeah, so you can get the whole kit, it looks like, for, what, $1,300 with
yeah, the that's 18, right.
18-70.
And it's really just an amazing camera. I couldn't recommend it highly.
Just one thing I want to say before we move
Please.
Beyond that, which is both the, you know, the D70 and the Rebel come mm-hmm. with or give you the option of getting that wide-angle lens.
Yeah.
Some people go, well, I don't know if I should get it or not. Because of the magnification factor with those cameras, you know, you probably don't have an 18-millimeter lens hanging around in your, you know, existing
right.
camera bag. And they tend to be expensive when you buy them individually. And so, you know, it's probably a good idea to get the lens if you don't already have
Definitely.
Something really wide.
Great. Well, Derek, let's go ahead and talk a little bit more. Let's talk about your book now. Your book is called Digital Photography Hacks. It's by O'Reilly. It's 100 industrial strength tips and tools for the digital photographer. Now, the hack series of from O'Reilly, Miles, can you give a reason why they call it hacks?
They aren't stuff that you would normally find in the manual, or they might be something that just isn't intuitive with regards to a particular product. They could be like, oh, here's some new and interesting way that you know, people have been using them, but hasn't been officially sanctioned by the company.
So that's kind of what their hacks are. Someone extending what is normal.
Right.
Is that? Would you agree with that, Derek? Is that what you mean by the hack series?
Well, you know, it's an interesting conversation. Actually, you know, what O'Reilly's trying to do, and, you know, O'Reilly's been part of, you know, the open source movement and kind of, you know, undocumented computing from the get-go. It actually got it to start writing manuals or things that didn't have manuals, and we've just sort of, you know, evolved from there. But, you know, the hacks sort of got some, you know, a bad connotative definition, you know, because the news would always go, hackers broke into Bank of America, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're always kind of using it as this black hat sort of thing. And actually, hacking is, as you guys know, is a tradition in computing that's actually quite noble, which is coming up with creative workarounds and solutions to things that the manufacturer didn't provide you originally.
Right.
You know, how to hook things together and stuff like that. So what we wanted to do with this whole series, and the whole series is actually doing quite well. Google Hacks was the one that kind of made the big splash, and then there's been a number that followed since, including this title. But, you know, we call it, you know, industrial strengths, tips, and tricks, and we actually define hacks as a creative, you know, solution to an interesting problem. And, you know, so basically in digital photography, for example, you have an interesting problem. You want to, you know, shoot a picture at night of somebody, and you want the Golden Gate Bridge that's in the background to show up as well. You don't want everything just to turn to black, you know. Now, you know, this isn't... you know, in advanced photography, you know, this technique's been around for a while, but a lot of people really don't realize that it's a lot easier with a digital camera. So we actually, you know, make a hack out of that.
Okay, so how do you do that? How do you make the background not, or the person not turn black with the background bright?
Yeah, it's there's a couple ways, but, you know, the whole idea, here's what, you know, this is what we do. We actually sort of explain what happens and then, you know, present you with the options to solve it. What happens is when you turn on your flash in auto mode, the camera defaults to 1/60th of a second. They've been doing that since the beginning of time. You know, it's mm-hmm. just like your meter is calibrated for, you know, a deep blue sky and green foliage. That's just the way it's always been, and even in digital cameras, it's that way. Well, the problem is that shutter speed is too fast to capture, you know, subtle lighting, such as, you know, a night scene in mm-hmm. the background or whatever. So all you really have to do in order to get both the subject illuminated and the background is find a way to slow down that shutter speed more like to a 15th of a second or longer.
And then be really steady when you take the photo.
Well, yeah, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, I really recommend that, you put it on the ledge of something, or you carry a little pocket tripod or whatever.
In fact, tip number one is get a pocket tripod.
I mean, I just come right out of the gate with that because, you know, so many of the techniques that I describe later in the book require you to steady the camera. And, you know, tripods are like what I was saying earlier about digital cameras, which is most people, most serious photographers have one, and most of the time it's at home in the closet because yeah. it's too big to lug around. If you get a nice little light pocket one, like, a, you know, the Pedco UltraPod 2, which I just think is a fantastic tripod, you know, it's you can just stick it in your back pocket, in your backpack or whatever, and then when you come along where you want to take a shot that's better than everyone else's, a lot of times that little tripod will help you do it.
We're talking with Derek Story, photographer and author. And, Derek, we're going to continue our conversation. We're going to talk about polarized lenses and how to use a polarized lens on even a small camera with no lens mount or no filter mount. So we'll talk about that in just a second. We're going to stay with us, Derek, please. Everyone else, stay with us. We're going to be taking your calls now. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and click on Send a Message. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. And we're speaking with digital photographer and author Derek Story, and we're going to be taking your calls in just a moment.
This week in This American Life, we've all been hearing about these private contractors, civilians, who work in Iraq in great danger, doing all sorts of jobs the U.S. military used to do. But we haven't heard a lot from them. Who they are, why they're there.
19.5 years in the military, 2 master's degrees. Only job I could find in real American business was as a clerk, $17,000 a year.
An hour with American civilians in Iraq this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. We are taking your calls to talk with Derek Story about digital photography. And, Derek, I want to talk quickly before we get into our phone calls. One of your hacks, hack number 18 in your book, use sunglasses as a polarizing filter.
Yeah, I love that one.
What is a polarizing filter used for?
Your camera, you know, digital cameras, one of the great things about them is a lot of filters that we used to have to put on the outside are built in through the white balance function.
Mm-hmm.
Such as warming up, like an overcast day and things like that. That's all in there. The one that isn't in there is a polarizer filter. And that's probably one of the most used filters in traditional photography. And really what it does is it helps remove glare from surfaces And by doing so, by getting rid of that kind of that stray, unwanted reflective line, everything else becomes more saturated and, you know, and actually more pleasing to the eye. And where you really notice that is like when you're shooting landscape, and it really deepens the blue sky and makes and the clouds and stuff really jump out, really creates a dramatic effect.
These one-button cameras, though, these small digital cameras, they don't have any filter mounts. You can't buy a filter that attaches, right?
No, you can't. It tends to be one of the drawbacks. So, you know, this is great hacks territory, right? Because, you know, there's your problem. They don't have a filter mount. But, yeah, you know, these cameras are pretty high quality and capable of taking excellent shots. So, you know, why deny yourself the ability to shoot a great landscape or even to take reflection out of water, you know, if you want to shoot, let's say, a lily pad that's, you know, in a pool there. So the easiest thing to do is really is buy yourself a good pair, if you don't already have a pair, of good polarizing sunglasses. And the best ones are usually, you know, the more neutral tone ones. Don't get something that's, you know, overly, you know, sepia or something like that. Just a good polarizing pair of sunglasses that are comfortable to wear and that, you know, make the world look good when you're bopping around. And then when you see, and, you know, now you have like a preview, right? You know, because you're looking at the world the way that you're able to photograph it. And if you see something that's beautiful, like a landscape or whatever, simply take off the glasses, put the one of the lens of the glasses right up against, you know, the front of your camera shooting lens. And, you know, you can look through the LCD monitor and see the effect. And you will essentially be attaching a polarizing filter to that camera and be able to put that effect in your shot. And
so
it works great.
So speaking as someone who isn't very well versed in photography in general, I'm curious as to what are the advantages to using, for example, this polarizing lens, sunglasses in front of a camera or a polarizing lens itself, over with a digital camera, just taking the photo without any type of lens and then post-processing in Photoshop or some other similar.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question, right? Because, you know, with digital photography, you always do sort of have, you know, the later on when I get back to my computer option. I think the polarizing effect in Photoshop is sort of difficult to do. It's, you know, one of the more...
Actually, I mean, from a physical perspective, polarizing the light is something completely different than color balancing. It actually increases the dynamic range the camera picks up if you use the polarized lens.
It does.
And what's... excuse me, Derek, for trying to explain this to Miles, but...
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you're going to get highlights, bright spots, and the polarizing light's going to take those bright spots out, but not take out other light in the room, in the shot. Therefore, the camera doesn't have to compensate for those bright spots, so it can reduce its view, if you will, by focusing on the now bright spot, which is less than the previous bright spot. Therefore, it broadens the depth of the color range that it can get. It's kind of a tough discussion, and it's... Polarizing is wrapped up in quantum physics, so
especially
let's not
when you look at
it.
Windshields of cars,
yeah.
Some of them have an effect,
yeah.
Like a splotchy effect.
And
you could
compensate a lot of the problems that you'd have without a filter, but you can't really get that dynamic range back in Photoshop. You could you'd artificially create it using saturation tools or something.
But it's a very physical thing, though, and I think that's why it's hard to recreate in Photoshop.
There's another thing that's going on is, If you take a lot of photos and you think, well, I'll fix this later, that means you're doing processing work later. It's best to get the best photo possible. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a call now. It's from Santa Cruz. Jeff, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Thank you for waiting for so long.
Oh, it wasn't that long. I was just happening to be in the bookstore reading some reviews on the D70 from Nikon yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And turned on your program, and here you are talking about it. and I have shot film for a long time, and I've had Nikon products all along. I had an FE I used for years, and originally started out with an Ikermat. Then I got the FE was stolen. I got an M70, which I absolutely can't stand. It's just way too complex, and I thought there was something wrong with me, and I went to the photo store, and the guy says, says, yeah, you have to pretty much carry your manual around with that one. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of going digital. I mean, I'm on the computer all the time, and I like to use Photoshop. And so I'm thinking about going digital. And the question is has to do with this 1.5 multiplying of lens length, or cutting it back, essentially. Or,
mm-hmm.
And that's kind of disturbing to me because I don't like shooting with it. Talking standard format now, I don't like shooting with a 28 millimeter lens. When I do wide angle shots, I like to include some close up foreground, and I just don't seem to get the dynamic composition I can with a 24, even though it's just a little shorter, you know. So that means I'd have to get with like a 13 millimeter lens.
I'm sorry,
16 millimeter.
Not exactly. The multiplier is more complicated than that. Derek, do you want to address this? I'll take a stab at it, Derek, and let you correct me if it's wrong.
I mean, there's a short answer than the long answer.
Let me give it a shot. Sorry to cut you off, Derek, but let me give it a shot. Basically, Jeff, it's not exactly that your smaller lens is going to be multiplied to be a bigger lens. It's not really a 1.5 multiplier in the traditional sense, like replacing the lens on a normal 35. What the issue is that you're cropping the regular 35 image, because the LCD screen is actually, I mean, the pickups, rather, the CCD.
The image sensor.
The image sensor is smaller than 35 millimeter film. So therefore, you only see a cropped version of what that lens would see for 35 millimeter film. But it's not equivalent to putting on a different lens, because the dynamics of the lens are still the same. It's just imagining cropping it all the time. So the close and far shots are the same. You're just not going to get as wide a shot.
Yeah,
Derek, does that do you?
And I go along with that completely. Is what you're basically doing is putting the same lenses on your camera that you've been putting on your 35 millimeter camera, because you know they want to standardize these things. Some companies like Olympus are saying, hey, no, we just want to start all over, and that's what they've done with their SLR. But
to throw out my lenses. Yeah.
But, you know, Nikon and Canon in particular, they know, hey, our customers got a bunch of lenses already. They love them, and they want to use them on their digital cameras. So on the cameras that are, you know, more at the lower end of the digital SLR spectrum, the image sensors are smaller than 35 millimeter film, just like what Lyle's saying here. And so it changes the relationship. You know, if you can picture in your mind the way that the lens is projecting the light, you know, where it goes through, and then, you know that those pictures we've all seen. Well, just imagine that a lot of that image that lens is projecting is going, you know, outside of the image sensor.
Yeah, I got that.
The image sensor is just grabbing part of it.
Can I ask a question here now?
Please.
So, in other words, like the effect you get from, distortions at different lengths, for instance, like when you use a telephoto to compress things that are particular distances apart, you want them to look closer together, these kinds of things are going to not...
Remain the same, yeah.
Well, I mean, they're going to remain the same, but in other words, you have to kind of adjust for them, essentially. You have to keep in mind that, well, I'm shooting with maybe my normal 105 lens, and therefore it's going to have the size of an image of about a 155, but it's not going to have a focal length distortion effect of a 155. It's going to be like,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I guess that takes some getting used to.
It does.
It's actually remarkably fast that you get used to it, because, we're so adaptable, and, we're talking about a visual thing here. And, remember that, one of the big differences between cameras and, us walking around in real life is that us walking around in real life, we are constantly processing at a very high rate all the different light temperatures that are around us and focusing and all that sort of stuff. We're fantastic at it. And cameras, of course, they don't adjust for, white balance, as fast or as easily as we do. The point I'm trying to make is that, we have such an adaptable system built into our head that you'd be surprised once you start using a different camera for a little bit, your whole way of seeing the world will adapt, actually rather quickly. And there'll be some differences. But overall, I think, if you enjoy photography, you would enjoy that camera.
So just quickly, once again, on the same, trying to get the equivalent of a 24 millimeter lens. Say I stick my 24 on there. Oh no, they got the 18 to the zoom on there, right?
Yeah, 18 to 70.
So if I set it at 18, boy, I'm just wondering if I'm going to be able to get that kind of a dynamic kind of a look to my pictures that I'm looking for that I couldn't get with my old 28s. Or is there a shorter length lens they can use that's not a fisheye or something?
You know, I would recommend before you purchase one, if you're thinking about purchasing one, go and play with one.
Yeah.
Find a store that will let you play with it, and then you'll know what you want.
That's a good idea.
That's what I had to do, and mm-hmm. I recommend it.
I'm glad you're happy with your camera.
And
that's good.
And definitely take a look at the Canon as well. But I don't know what kind of lenses you have. But
I've got a bunch of Nikon lenses.
Yeah, that's kind of defines
what I've been waiting for. Yeah. Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Jeff, for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Now, of course, Derek, the concern that Jeff might want to think about is that it's possible for someone to make a CCD that's 35 millimeters. It might come out that someone will produce a CCD that's much more like film.
Well, it is happening on the higher end models, but mm-hmm. you got to pay big bucks for them right now. We all know how the world of technology goes, and unless you really need that, you know, that big CCD, that $13,000 investment or $8,000 investment that you make right now, depending on what model you get, is going to be half that price real soon. So,
mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about some effects. One of the things that makes a great romantic shot, if you will, is the starlight effect, where a light source actually kind of turns into a star and kind of fades. Beautiful look. How do you do that with a digital camera? That never seems to happen with the point and click. How do you do it?
Yeah, this is one where you physically have to put a filter over the front. A great place to use this effect is that, if you're going to any weddings this spring or this summer or whatever, at wedding receptions, almost everyone these days has those little lights, and you can just do some fabulous stuff with your point and shoot. But there's external filters that you can get, and a company that I like that I think makes very affordable external filters and the little holders that go on your digital point and shoots is Kokin, C-O-K-I-N. They're actually a French company that has been around photography for a long time, and they've really been paying a lot of attention to the digital point-and-shoot world lately, because they realize they're just looking at the numbers and seeing all those cameras out there, which are potential customers. And they make a number of using those starlight filters. I list them in the book, the company and actually show one of the filters mounted on a camera. Another thing that you can do, though, if you just you're feeling kind of hackish and don't feel like spending the $25 for the holder and the filter itself, is take an existing filter that you have, an old filter out of the filter drawer, let's say a UV filter, and if you take a glass cutter to it with a little ruler, the way that the starlight effect is created is if you just cut some grooves, do them parallel and crosshatch them in the glass filter, and then you can just hold it that in front of the lens, and then if you just rotate it a little bit, it will actually rotate the starburst.
Okay.
And it's a good way just to play around with the effect.
How many lines?
If you take a standard diameter filter, let's say a 55 millimeter filter. I would usually put about 8 lines each way, and start from there. And then you can always add more if you wanna do it. When you look at the filters that are commercially, they have the lines closer together a little bit. But I've had a lot of fun just playing with the different effects. And what I usually do is I start with maybe 8 lines each direction, see how it looks, and then, keep adding more. Whereas, once you etch them in, you can't take them back out.
Right. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Our guest via phone is author and photographer Derek Story. We're taking your calls about digital photography. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Coralitas, Barry, welcome to Geek Speak.
Fun.
Yes.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, quite well, thank you. What's your question?
Well, I'm looking to get into doing digital panoramas, and I've purchased the QuickTime virtual reality head, and I've just been playing around a little bit with that. And I'm wondering, is there any programs that allow you to do, with QuickTime, a narrated version of a, like if I wanted to narrate a panoramic scene where somebody is panning through a photograph, are they able to do narration in conjunction with viewing the photograph?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, I mean, the reason, just to do a little background before we get to it, the reason why I think it's an interesting question is because, you know, the difference between VR, virtual reality, and a regular QuickTime movie is that in VR, it's not necessarily a linear experience, right? You know, the user has control. The user can go, you know, they can move to the left, they can move to the right, they can go up and down depending on, you know, how you've authored this thing. And if you put hotspots in, they can even, you know, choose, you know, doors to go into and so forth. So creating narration with that seems, you know, the first thing that I would think is, you know, how do you actually tie narration to user movements?
Right.
And that's something I haven't played with. I would look at, did you look at Apple's VR Studio?
VR Studio? No, I haven't yet.
Take a look at that. See, get a good look at the features and specs on that and see if they have a way to, you know, basically what you'd be doing is wiring together. You probably could wire audio with the hotspots.
When you click on something in the picture, it would play the audio for that area.
Exactly. That's kind of something I'm looking for.
Derek, is it possible in these VR things to, like, create the VR, then rotate it around, recording that rotation, and then narrate it and play it as a normal movie so it's not actually VR that's playing? Do you know if you can do
that? Yes. Yeah. I'm almost positive you can do that. You know, because then, you know, you've sort of removed the user control. And, you know, then you have basically a real QuickTime movie, which you can add, you know, unlimited audio tracks and so forth. So, but I think it's if you want to allow the user to retain control, and then, you know, wiring together audio, you know, that would be, boy, if you make any headway on that, make sure you drop me an email, Derek, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, @O'Reilly.com. Because, you know, I'd love to see what you do there.
Can you spell the O'Reilly?
Certainly. Pardon? The publisher is O-R-E-I-L-L-Y. There is an apostrophe, but not in the email. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can also go to Derek's site, storyphoto.com, and from there you can find his an email address for him.
Yeah, there's
I'm sorry, say that again.
DerekStory@.com.
Okay.
Story photo. Thank you. Story photo. And you, we'll be giving that information at the end of the show as well. Thank you very much for the call,
Barry. I have one other question concerning the panoramic setup. I'm actually looking at buying a Better Light system. Are you familiar with that?
What was the name again?
Better Light.
Made by Better Light. They're in San Carlos. It's a panoramic. It's actually a 4x5 digital scanning back that you use with your view camera, your 4x5
view camera. Oh, wow. That sounds really
cool. It has a control box. And it's got a turntable that you mount your camera on, and it will do single shots or a 360 if you like. And we're talking like really big time, you know, pixels and you know,
great for product shots. You know, that's what that's used for a lot. Apple, I think they do a good job with that, and you know, where you're allowed to spin around on the computers and all that kind of stuff. I'm not familiar with that particular lighting system, but I know guys who enjoy that kind of photography, it's a tedious kind of photography, you know, it's very precise and so forth. You know, people that enjoy it really love it, and you can produce some stunning results with the turntable and good lighting.
Thank you, Barry, for the call.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
We're gonna go right to Pat in Watsonville. Pat, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have the new owner of Bay Photo in Watsonville, and I don't sell a whole lot of cameras, but I counsel people all the time on how to get started with digital photography and how to upgrade from point-and-shoot to the bigger SLR-style cameras. And one of the things I'm constantly counseling people to do is look really hard at the Canon products, because they have been leaders in digital development for decades now, going all the way back to really, really early stuff that they were marketing primarily to press photographers. And so they're setting the standard, I think, for primarily the documentation and their controls. For instance, if you go in the manuals to the Canon cameras, the most common question I get is, if I put this chip in my camera, you know, say a 512, how many pictures can I get? And it's, of course, there's a lot of variables. You know, what resolutions are you setting and all this and that, how many megapixels is your camera? If you go back to the manual in the Canon, which is unusual, they've got a table, and it breaks it down, so you can answer that question very, very easily. And throughout their product line, their documentation is like that. It's very, very straightforward, very easy to understand. And so somebody who has been shooting film or has been shooting just with a point-and-shoot can make a jump to digital without this really steep learning curve, which is really intimidating to a lot of people. And they're, you know, of course, if you move up to the SLR-style things, their products, I think pixel for pixel, are quite a bit cheaper than, say, Nikon or some of the other ones, and every bit is good.
Canon, instance, you're talking about Canon?
Yeah, you can get a digital Rebel now with 6.3 megapixels and a really nice Canon zoom lens for less than $1,000 if you look around, you know, less than $800 if you really look.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things, you know, I try to shoot with as many of the different brands as I can. One of the things that jumps out at me when I shoot with Canon, which is sort of an extension of what you're saying here, is that their user interface on the camera itself also, I think, is pretty friendly. And
yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I think they've done a good job with that. You know.
Well, yeah, the thing with the digital that's very interesting is camera manufacturers have spent 20 years trying to make photography easier, and then when we switched to digital, instantly it got difficult again.
Yeah.
And it's taken a while for the digital camera manufacturers to come around and realize that ease of use is in many ways far more important than the pixel power or anything else, because if the people can't understand it, they won't use it or they won't buy it. And Canon, I think, is way out ahead on that one. And then, you know, for all of your, you know, neophyte listeners, I suppose the Geek Speak audience, this is sort of preaching to the choir, but, you know, when in doubt, turn up the resolution. Memory is getting cheaper every minute. And forget about anything 4 megapixels or smaller at this point. I wouldn't spend another $100 and get the 4 or the 5 megapixel cameras. The small ones are not really worth it anymore.
Pat, thank you very much for the call. Pat, owner of the Bay Photo in Watsonville.
All right, thanks
for calling. Quick email from someone. If you want to share photographs online with people, take a look at photolog.net service that allows you to share photos. If you're interested in the person that did just and send that in, his URL or her URL is photolog.net/earth_beneath. Sounds like an interesting thing, photolog.net. Derek, we're quickly running out of time, but I wanted to ask you if there's anything that you wanted to mention specifically about digital photography, a suggestion or tip, one of your favorites from the book?
Yeah, well, you know, what I just wanted to jump on a comment from the previous caller real quick, which is, you know, when I tell people, you know, here's a couple things that I think you should always do. One of them is, you know, shoot at the highest resolution and at the highest quality setting always. You know, and then and get a bigger memory card. When you buy the camera or when you're budgeting for the camera, make sure that you include, you know, a nice big 256, 512 or larger memory card with that. That allows you to shoot at those high resolutions. In the end, you're going to end up with a better digital negative that, you know, is more versatile and you can make big prints, so on and so forth. So that's one thing I always like to emphasize. And then the other thing is, too, is, you know, one tip that would improve your shots of people more than anything else, I think, is that when you're taking pictures of people outdoors, turn on the flash. Take it off auto mode and put it on fill flash mode, which every digital camera has. Make sure you're standing within 8 or 10 feet and give it a whirl. I think you'd be surprised by how it changes your shot.
Especially in bright sunlight, it really takes those shadows out.
It really helps. It really helps. And the camera does all the work for you.
One of the things that Pat suggested, which made a lot of sense to me, he said, you know, go with Canon. It's a really great option. The other thing that's really convenient about that is, for example, the small cameras, the pocket cameras you have with you all the time.
Yes.
A lot of their interface, the Canon interface, remains very similar when you migrate to when you get another camera. So let's say you get an SLR and a little mini, and they have the very similar interfaces. That's really convenient not to have to switch interfaces. It's like, you know, switching between a Mac and a PC. It's kind of hard to do.
Yeah,
you can do it, of course.
If you don't have glass already in a particular mount, then I think that's definitely an area. The Canon area is a good one to look to. But if you do have glass, take a good look at that manufacturer, because chances are they're doing a good job, too.
We had one more call about solar rig for charging batteries on the go. Michael from Gilroy called in. He left already on the phone. He's not on the phone anymore. But what's your thought on that, recharging batteries on the go?
If you don't have access to an automobile, you know, where you have the cigarette lighter option, which is just a terrific one. But if you're really on the go, let's say out in the woods or something, the solar battery chargers, I think the best way to go is then to get a camera that takes AA batteries, and a number of them still do, Olympus. The C5060 is a really good camera that's compact and is 5 megapixels. That takes AA's, and there are other ones, too. And then because it's easier to find good solar chargers for the AA's than to come up with a custom solution for your lithium battery.
Right. Well, thank you for that information. We've got to cut it. I'm cutting you off, unfortunately.
Yep.
Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our guest today, Derek Story's recent book, Digital Photography Hacks, is published by O'Reilly. You can find out more information about Derek Story at his website and look at photographs from him. Go to www.storyphoto.com. You can also read articles of his at macdevcenter.com. It's one word. Derek, thank you very much for being on Geek Speak today.
Oh, it's been great talking with you.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Our geeks today were Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Thank you for participating in Geek Speak. To those of you that called in, thank you very much for making Geek Speak what it is. We do this show because of you, and I love doing it, so thanks for calling in. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDBH San Otto, or on the web at kusp.org. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.